So I think we stopped on 12, didn't we? Yeah, we actually finished the cycle in slide 11, although I think I forgot to mention in slide 11 that final enzyme, which is responsible for transforming malate into oxaloacetate in order to get back to the start-finish line, is called malate dehydrogenase, for good reason, right? It's another energy yielding step because it's able to reduce NAD plus into NADH. So that was where we left off, and slide 12 is just a summary of the whole thing. I think it's probably worth it just to go through this again now that we can see it all in one cycle, on one slide, I mean. So recall that the start-finish line is where the two carbon unit in the form of acetate, or the acetyl group that's being carried by coenzyme A, comes in and meets the final product, if you think about this as having a start-finish line, which is oxaloacetate. You see that happening at the top. The S-CoA represents just the coenzyme part of that, but it's carrying the two carbons in green in the form of the acetyl group that it's carrying. And what kind of reaction is that? What's happening when oxaloacetate combines with the acetyl that coenzyme A is carrying? Right, it's a condensation reaction catalyzed by citrate synthase. That's why this thing is called the citric acid cycle, because citrate, its other name, its name when you consider it not to be deprotonated, is citric acid, right? Notice, though, that I don't remember whether I mentioned this before or not, but what else do you notice about citrate? Speaking of names of the cycle, it is an acid, yeah. That's why it's called the citric acid cycle. But what are its other names? Krebs cycle, and I don't see Krebs up there anywhere. So what's the third name? The tricarboxylic acid cycle, right? What makes something a carboxylic acid? It has a carboxyl group. So what makes something a tricarboxylic acid? It has three carboxyl groups, which citrate does, as you see there. It had two already as oxaloacetate coming into it, but the green one is added when you combine the two-carbon acetyl group from coenzyme A to oxaloacetate to make that citrate. Okay, so citrate is the six-carbon compound that's produced, and we're going to get some energy out of that, but first we need to rearrange it, right? Rearrangement is isomerization, and that's what that next step is. Citrate gets isomerized into isocitrate by aconitase. That doesn't yield any energy, but it puts the carbon skeleton in a way that the next enzyme can actually get some energy out of that. So now there are going to be two sequential reactions that do the same thing. And what is that same thing that these next two reactions are doing? Yes, oxidative decarboxylation. Twice in a row. So the first one is performed by isocitrate dehydrogenase, one of four dehydrogenases that work in this cycle. Those are the energy-yielding steps, right? These dehydrogenations. But this one is, this dehydrogenation is a oxidative decarboxylation because you're also stripping away a carbon in the form of carbon dioxide, right? So it's oxidative because it's able to reduce NAD plus into NADH. You're only able to do that if you can only reduce something if you oxidize something, right? It's the fuel that's being oxidized, but it's also being decarboxylated. So that gives you now a 5-carbon compound, alpha-ketoglutarate. And remember why it was called an alpha-keto acid, or why it's named for the fact that it's an alpha-keto acid? Anyone remember why?
Because
Right. It's because the keto group, which is the carbonyl here, is right next to the actual carboxyl group that makes it an acid. Okay, so that alpha-ketoglutarate, a 5-carbon compound, is then also oxidatively decarboxylated in the next step. And that involves an enormous enzyme complex, the alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase complex, that is very, very similar to what other enzyme complex? The pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. And where did that operate? In the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, which happens right before the citric acid cycle. That's what gave us acetyl coenzyme A from the pyruvate that glycolysis spit out. So that is another oxidative decarboxylation, so you end up reducing more coenzyme, NADH is produced in other words, but you also produce a second CO2. Now, what are the sources of the CO2 overall in this overall oxidation of glucose, which is happening, starting with glucose, in other words? What are the sources of CO2? What is it? Well, that's what's left over. It's not really the source of the CO2. Oh, you mean in the Krebs cycle.
Yes.
But I'm talking about overall. The overall process, starting with glucose, has three places where you produce CO2, right? The first of those is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And so that represents one of the 6 carbons that was originally in glucose. Then you have 2 more decarboxylations in the citric acid cycle itself, bringing it up to 3 carbons of the 6 that were in glucose. But you multiply all 3 of those by 2, right? Because you have 2 pyruvates being produced by glycolysis. So that represents the complete dismantling of the carbon skeleton by the time you get to that second decarboxylation of the citric acid cycle. In other words, you have no more fuel to use other than the intermediates that are going to be processed here to get back to oxaloacetate, but you've already made a lot of energy stored in the form of reduced coenzymes, right? And you're going to make even more. So that oxidative decarboxylation of alpha-ketoglutarate transforms that alpha-ketoglutarate into a 4-carbon compound because it's decarboxylated. And that 4-carbon compound is succinyl coenzyme A because coenzyme A picks up that 4-carbon compound. All right? The next step then is to use the enzyme succinyl coenzyme A synthetase to transform that into succinate. Basically just strips it from the coenzyme A, right? And in the process allows for phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. That's the only place in the citric acid cycle where you make ATP. And what kind of process produces that ATP? Substrate level phosphorylation, exactly. The succinate now, well, I shouldn't say now, the succinate is still a 4-carbon compound. So after you get from 5 to 4, nothing changes as far as the size of the carbon skeleton, right? It's going to remain 4, but the rest of the cycle is just about rearranging it and getting some more energy out of it in order to regenerate what you need for more acetyl coenzyme A to come in. What you need for more acetyl coenzyme A to come in is oxaloacetate. So the rest of the cycle is about regenerating that start-finish line and along the way getting some more energy in the form of reduced coenzymes. That happens first when succinate gets dehydrogenated into fumarate under the catalytic help of succinate dehydrogenase. But what is special about this enzyme compared to the others that are operating in this cycle? Yes, it is not membrane bounded. No, membrane bound. Those sound the same, but they mean different things. Membrane bounded because bounded is the past tense of bound, meaning bounded means surrounded by, having a boundary with. A membrane bounded object is something that is enclosed by a membrane, which is why when we talk about eukaryotes, we talk about them having membrane bounded organelles. Membrane bound, on the other hand, that bound word by itself is the past tense of bind, which means to tie to. So a membrane bound object is something that is connected to a membrane. It's part of a membrane, but it's not enclosed by the membrane. And that's true of succinate dehydrogenase. This enzyme is actually part of, it's tied to, the inner mitochondrial membrane, whereas these other ones are not. That's one thing that's special about it. What's another thing that's unusual in terms of energy extraction? Yes, this dehydrogenation does not put the electrons and protons that are stripped from the fuel onto NAD+, like the other ones did. Instead, this puts it onto the alternative coenzyme, flavin adenine dinucleotide, instead of nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Why does that make a difference? Well, we're going to talk about this more once we complete this process, because remember that even though this is the end of the unit and the test is Thursday, it's not the end of the process, because we haven't talked about the rest of cellular respiration yet, which is oxidative phosphorylation. That oxidative phosphorylation step includes two major processes, right? Anyone care to say what those are? Electron transport and what? And chemiosmosis, exactly. That's what's going to make most of the ATP for us, using energy stored in the form of these electrons being carried by these coenzymes. That relies on the coenzymes dropping those electrons off to the members of the electron transport chains. But there's a difference in how FAD and NAD do this. I should say NADH and FADH2, the reduced forms. The difference is that FADH2 doesn't have as high a transfer potential. So it's unable to drop its electrons off to the first member of the chain. It has to skip that first member and drop it off to the second member, which means the electrons don't end up dropping as far in energy level and they're from FADH2 compared to NADH, and therefore the energy released by that successive transfer of electrons from FADH2 does not end up powering the pumping of as many protons by the chain itself. And it's the pumping of the protons to produce that proton gradient that pays off in terms of phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. In other words, the energy stored by FADH2 is not as much as the useful energy stored by NADH, and therefore you don't end up making as many ATPs per molecule of FADH2 as you do per molecule of NADH. Does all that make sense? Like I said, it's really that's part of the next chapter, but I want to tie it together. All right, so at this point, we're still at, like I said, four carbons. We'll remain at four carbons, but this what we're at right now is fumarate. And what is the kind of reaction that fumarate undergoes? You can cheat and look. You're right, it's a hydration reaction. How many places do we require water in this cycle? Two places where it requires a net addition of water. Because remember, we don't count the one where we lose the water and then and gain it in one basic step. So the other one is when we have this condensation reaction to begin with. Water was required up there, as you see. Well, water is required, of course, for this hydration reaction. And that doesn't get us any energy, but it does get us into a situation, as far as the intermediates are concerned, that we can get energy in the next step. So the conversion of fumarate to malate is catalyzed by fumarase, named just for its substrate, obviously. And then malate can then undergo the final dehydrogenation in the overall cycle. Malate dehydrogenase, of course, catalyzes that. That transforms it into oxaloacetate, which is what the goal is, because we need oxaloacetate to continue this cycle, because it's the only thing that can accept the acetate from acetyl coenzyme A. Okay? But in that process, we have the added benefit that the dehydrogenation allows us to reduce more NAD plus into NADH. And therefore, that NADH molecule, like all the other NADH molecules made along the way, represent multiple ATPs that can be made from that useful energy. All right, any questions on the overview? Okay. In slide 13, I don't want to read this whole table to you. You can read this to yourself. But this is just another way of looking at the summary. It might help you study for it. Notice that it's there are letters under this type column that tell you what we were just talking about, the type of reaction occurring in each one. Although I think there's an, I remember seeing an error in this. Fumarase, the fumarase catalyzed reaction is not oxidation, right? What is it? We just said hydration, so it should really be C, not E here. Everything else is right, though. And keep in mind that the similarity of alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase complex to pyruvate dehydrogenase complex extends to the fact that they use exactly the same coenzymes, cofactors, which is why you have lipoic acid, FAD, and TPP listed here, just like you had for pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. All right, let's talk a little bit about the control of the citric acid cycle. Slide 14. So you see more than the cycle here. The top part, of course, is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, which produces the acetyl coenzyme A that the cycle needs. That's one way of producing it. Like I said before, that's not the only source of acetyl coenzyme A. We'll talk more about this later as well, but another way that acetyl coenzyme A is made is through what's called beta oxidation, which is how fatty acids are catabolized for energy. A fatty acid is a long chain of carbons, right? Well, without getting into the particulars at this point, what happens is that two carbons at a time are cleaved off of that chain, however long it is, in that fatty acid. And two carbon units are acetyl groups, right? So acetyl coenzyme A is produced when you break this fatty acid into two-piece chunks, one step at a time. But anyway, acetyl coenzyme A, of course, is also made when you oxidatively decarboxylate pyruvate. If you think about this in terms of starting with glucose. And that's an input into the cycle. So, well, that is a control point. It's not technically a control point of the cycle because that's a separate process from the cycle. But this control point at the top of this slide is something we've already talked about. We already talked about the control of the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate in its own chapter. But notice what's happening with the pluses and the minuses here. ADP and pyruvate both stimulate the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. Why does that make sense? Right. When you have a bunch of ADP, that means you don't have much ATP. And therefore, you're in need of energy, which is why it would make sense to transform that pyruvate into acetyl coenzyme A so that you can operate the citric acid cycle, which produces which allows for eventually the production of a lot more ATP once you allow for oxidative phosphorylation. And pyruvate, a buildup of pyruvate means that you're getting backed up on pyruvate, right? Process it. And therefore, that's stimulatory. On the other hand, if you have plenty of ATP, plenty of acetyl coenzyme A, or plenty of energy in the form of reduced coenzymes, then it doesn't really make sense to keep adding to those things, which the cycle would. And therefore, the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex is inhibited in those cases. The cycle itself, though, has most of its regulation exercised at these two enzymes noted by the pink hash marks here. So the conversion of isocitrate into alpha-ketoglutarate, what enzyme is that? Isocitrate dehydrogenase, exactly. That's a major control point of the citric acid cycle. And high energy charge is inhibitory, as you would expect, for exactly the same reason, right? You have plenty of ATP already, don't bother running the cycle. Low energy charge means high ADP, so that turns it on. The next control point is the second in this series of oxidative decarboxylations. So that's the alpha-ketoglutarate dehydrogenase complex, the very next enzyme in the cycle. And similarly, high energy charge there will inhibit it for the same exact reason. Okay. 15. Once again, we see the citric acid cycle here in blue, just like we've been looking at it. But all these other arrows have been added because even though we've been talking about the citric acid cycle kind of in isolation, for only one purpose, we've been thinking about it only in terms of its use for ultimately producing more ATP. In other words, for catabolizing fuels, for energy metabolism. That's not the only use of the citric acid cycle. Its intermediates are useful for other purposes as well, because its intermediates, depending on which intermediate you're talking about, can be transformed into other biomolecules that the cell might need at that time. And so the citric acid cycle is a central biochemical hub that a lot of things connect to. It's not just about getting ATP eventually. And you can see that with these pink arrows. For instance, oxaloacetate, we've already discussed even before we got to the citric acid cycle, right? Where did oxaloacetate come up in the study of what? Gluconeogenesis, exactly, which makes sense considering this pink arrow, right? Oxaloacetate is a precursor to glucose in gluconeogenic tissues, like the liver. Right? Amino acids of various types can be produced, specifically the non-essential amino acids. There are essential amino acids, right, for humans. Those are the ones that we don't have the mechanism to produce on our own, so we have to get those in our diet. But more than half of the amino acids we can make out of other things, including some of these intermediates in citric acid cycle. Alpha-ketoglutarate allows us to make glutamate, which can be transformed into other amino acids. Glutamate itself is an amino acid. And aspartate can be made from oxaloacetate and then modified into other amino acids. So, yeah, go ahead.
I don't think you know what you said about oxaloacetate.
What I said is that oxaloacetate, we studied that even before we got to the citric acid cycle because it is an intermediate in gluconeogenesis, which is functionally the reverse of glycolysis, right? Glycolysis starts with glucose, ends with pyruvate. Pyruvate is the starting point, in a sense, for gluconeogenesis, if you start from scratch, and you go through oxaloacetate to do that. And so oxaloacetate, yes, it's a key intermediate in the citric acid cycle itself, but if you don't need the citric acid cycle to be running for the moment, if you're set for energy, then you can siphon off oxaloacetate for the purpose of producing glucose, if that's what you need. Okay, so that's what I mean by it being a central hub. It connects to a lot of things. Fatty acids can be made from citrate, as you see, and heme, which is, of course, important in blood cells, can be made from the succinyl-CoA intermediate. Now, this green arrow at the top between pyruvate and oxaloacetate, this is important because the cycle itself, of course, is a whole pathway. And if any of these intermediates gets depleted and you suddenly need to run the cycle again, well, if you just run it from the beginning, you can get to any one of these intermediates, right? And therefore restore them to the levels they need to be at. But you can't run it from the beginning unless you have oxaloacetate to accept the incoming acetyl-CoA, right? Which means if you've siphoned off oxaloacetate for the purposes of gluconeogenesis, for instance, and you don't have any available to receive acetyl coenzyme A, then you won't be able to run the cycle. Therefore, there needs to be a way to replenish oxaloacetate in case it gets too low. And that's what the green arrow is about. And this is also something we talked about before. This is that very first step of gluconeogenesis. And do you remember where that happened? Do you remember where gluconeogenesis, most of which occurs in the cytosol, where it starts? In the mitochondria, and exactly where we are. So pyruvate can get transformed using that first enzyme of the gluconeogenesis pathway into oxaloacetate, just for the purposes of restoring the ability of the cycle to operate. Anyone remember what that first enzyme is called? First enzyme of gluconeogenesis. Right, pyruvate carboxylase. Because what's happening there is pyruvate, which is how many carbons? 3, gets carboxylated. Not decarboxylated, it gets carboxylated. It adds a CO2 to it. So now you're to the 4-carbon oxaloacetate, and everything can operate again in terms of the citric acid cycle. Okay, 16. Oh, 16 is what I should have been showing you for this whole last 2 minutes that we've been talking about, because that's really what gives the name to the green arrow. But it's good for you to come up with it on your own. Anyway, that's what pyruvate carboxylase is all about. Do you understand what I'm saying, though, about the importance of restoring oxaloacetate compared to restoring other things? Because as long as you have this beginning and you have some acetyl-CoA to come into it, whatever else you're short of, you can just replenish by going through from the beginning to up to that point. But you can't start it without oxaloacetate. By the way, notice that fatty acids are shown here, like I told you earlier, as another source of acetyl-coenzyme A. So that's how we get most of the energy out of our fats, right? Most of our extra energy is stored as fat. We store a little bit as carbohydrate in the form of glycogen, but there's a limit to how much we can store as glycogen. If we're still taking in extra energy in the form of more food than we need, then we store that extra as fat, whether it's fat in the food or not. We turn it into fat, right? Why is it that we store it as fat? You're right. For the same amount of energy, it will weigh less than any other nutrient that we store the energy as. Because it has a higher energy density, meaning more energy per mass of fat than there is energy per mass of carbohydrate or protein. So to store that same amount of energy as something else, we would have to weigh more, which would itself cost us more energy to move around. It would be wasteful. But anyway, fatty acids are rich in energy because they have all those carbons in the hydrocarbon, the fatty acid component of fats. But what else do fats have? What is it? Glycerol, which is itself valuable, right? Not here, but we talked about how glycerol can feed into the glycolytic pathway earlier. So both major components, the two types of components of a fat, are useful energetically, but the fatty acid tails that get liberated once you break the fat down into its components feed directly into the citric acid cycle. And the citric acid cycle doesn't recognize the acetyl coenzyme A that's coming from fatty acids as being any different from ones that come from pyruvate and ultimately from glucose. So it operates exactly the same and it will end up producing a lot of ATP because an individual fatty acid has a lot of acetyls it can be broken into. And therefore, it will turn this cycle many times and produce a lot of NADHs, which will multiply into even more ATPs. All right, that leads us to 17, which I think is the last slide. And this is a cycle that we do not have operating in our bodies, unlike most of the ones we look at in this course. In fact, we animals are just about the only things that don't have it. At least we haven't found good evidence that animals have this operating. This is called the glyoxylate cycle, named for one of its intermediates down here on the bottom, glyoxylate. So plants are able to do this. Prokaryotes are able to do it. Well, certainly bacteria. I can't say for sure, but I would assume that archaea are able to do this as well. Fungi are able to do it. Protists are able to do it. So basically all the eukaryotes except for animals, at least most animals, are able to do this. We cannot. It would be nice if we were able to, though, because this glyoxylate cycle accomplishes something nifty. Notice its similarity, though, just by looking at it quickly, to the citric acid cycle itself. It's really just a variation of the citric acid cycle. It shares several of the enzymes and works in those steps identically to the citric acid cycle. But there's an important difference. For these acetyl coenzyme A's that are coming in from fatty acids being catabolized, like I was just talking about, if those go into the citric acid cycle, then there is no way around the fact that they're going to be dismantled into individual coenzyme A's. I mean, individual CO2s, sorry. Right? Even though oxaloacetate can be a starting point for glucose, if you go through gluconeogenesis, you can't really use, or we animals can't use, fatty acids to make glucose, because when we put our acetyl groups from acetyl coenzyme A into the citric acid cycle, we just dismantle them along the way, so there's no net buildup of carbon skeletons, which you need to make glucose. Does that make sense? And that's because of these decarboxylation steps that are in the citric acid cycle. That's the key difference between the tricarboxylic acid cycle, citric acid cycle, and this one, the glyoxylate cycle. There aren't decarboxylations here happening. Those are skipped. So it starts out exactly the same. Oxaloacetate receives two more carbons in the form of acetate being carried by coenzyme catalyzed by citrate synthase, just exactly like the citric acid cycle starts. And the next step is identical as well. That citrate gets isomerized into isocitrate by aconitase. What would be the next step if this were the citric acid cycle? Isocitrate would get transformed into what? Alpha-ketoglutarate first. And that involves decarboxylation, right? Alpha-ketoglutarate is a 5-carbon compound. Isocitrate is a 6-carbon compound. That doesn't happen here. And neither does the second decarboxylation. So instead, the isocitrate in the glyoxylate cycle will be catalyzed by isocitrate lyase into two products, succinate and glyoxylate, for which the cycle is named. Succinate, you already know, as an intermediate in the citric acid cycle, right? Well, notice you're starting with isocitrate, a 6-carbon compound. You're dismantling that into succinate, a four-carbon compound, and then the other two carbons are in glyoxylate itself. So succinate, in other words, you have incorporated your carbons from acetyl coenzyme A without spitting them off individually as carbon dioxide. And now this succinate can just go to the citric acid cycle where it is in the citric acid cycle and continue on to oxaloacetate without losing any carbons, right? It's just a rearrangement of those same four carbons. And once you get to oxaloacetate, you can use that for gluconeogenesis, which has the overall effect of producing glucose out of your fatty acid. Yeah. Right.
So you would be, so like plants or things that do this, they do both of them?
Right. That's exactly right.
What's the point of doing this for?
It allows the carbons from acetyl coenzyme A that you get from that the plant gets from catabolizing fatty acids to be not dismantled into individual carbon dioxides, but built up into a molecule that can be made into glucose. That's what the glyoxylate cycle's main utility is. It allows for gluconeogenesis using fatty acid acetyl coenzyme A as a starting point. All right, now, notice this is isocitrate lyase, and do you remember talking about the major classes of enzymes, what lyases are? Lyases are enzymes that break bonds by other means than by means other than hydrolysis, and that usually results in the formation of a double bond, or if it goes in reverse, the breaking of a double bond. Well, you see that happening right here, right? Glyoxylate has a carbonyl group in it. Anyway, that's a two-carbon compound, and now here's another major difference between the glyoxylate cycle and citric acid cycle. You have an additional coenzyme A, acetyl coenzyme A, coming into the situation. Not just at the top, down here as well. And so when you add the two carbons that acetyl coenzyme A is carrying to the two carbons of glyoxylate, you have another four-carbon compound. And that's the essence of this whole cycle, that you're building up skeletons rather than dismantling them. And so the enzyme responsible for this, since glyoxylate and the acetyl combine to form malate, is called malate synthetase. Synthase. Okay? Well, malate is also a player in the citric acid cycle. So once you have succinate and malate, which are produced by this, you have four carbon intermediates that can go back to get transformed into oxaloacetate and serve as precursors for glucose via gluconeogenesis. Now, this is important in organisms that have to produce a lot of carbohydrates, which organisms with cell walls do. And therefore, it makes sense that prokaryotes would have this, that fungi would have this, that plants would have this, and certain protists as well. Right? We don't have to make nearly as many complex carbohydrates because we don't have those cell walls. But it would be nice to be able to do this. We just have lost the ability to somewhere along evolutionary history. In terms of a plant, this probably makes best sense to you if you think about what's happening in a seed. In a seed, you have a tiny embryo of a sporophyte that's a generation of a plant that is getting ready to grow. To grow and escape that seed and grow into a full plant, it has to produce a bunch of carbohydrate that's going to become that stem it needs to grow into, right? Well, it has a lot of energy, that seed, in the form of fat that's stored in that seed efficiently as fat, but it's encased in this opaque seed, and therefore that embryo can't undergo photosynthesis, which would produce carbohydrates for it, right, out of the energy in sunlight. So it needs a way to transform fat into carbohydrate, which is exactly what the glyoxylate cycle is able to do. Allows it to grow into a big enough structure that it can now, once it's exposed to the sunlight, undergo photosynthesis to produce carbohydrates that way. All right, any questions on that? Just remember, we don't have that. In that case, we're done with the unit, and we can be done if you want, or you can ask me questions if you have any specific questions about any of the chapters, since we have some extra time. Or you can meet with me right now afterwards individually, but it's up to you guys. Okay.